Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k. Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast, where each week we bring you education and information that will help you take your next step in building wealth through real estate. My name is Lauren Wells, and I'm here with my co-host today, Chris Seveny. And on today's episode, we want to talk about note investing. As I guess some of you might know, that is how this podcast started out, as a note investing podcast. Specifically, we want to talk about what we call the three-dimensional approach to note investing that we take when evaluating, acquiring, and bringing a note to resolution. So, Chris, what is the three-dimensional approach that we take?
Happy Monday, first off, Lauren. Hope you are doing well today. Full disclosure, we have like 25 outtakes on this episode, so we've had a good time so far already. The three-dimensional approach, we also call it the three Ps, where we talk about the property, and that is really defining the property condition and the shape of the property, the person.
And the value.
Yes, of course, and the value. And we'll dive into much more detail in regards to some of the other aspects of the property. The next is the person, which involves why. Why is the loan distressed? What's a little background history on this person? Really kind of get an understanding of the situation that caused the delinquency. And the third P is position. What is the individual or the borrower's financial position currently, or the current status of that position? And what was it at the time of default? So in a high level, those are the three Ps that we look at when we're not only acquiring a deal, but also after acquisition, if we do proceed with acquiring the deal, to the type of workout we're going to be attempting to remediate with the delinquency.
So why is this different from approaches other companies might take, or how is this unique? How is this approach unique?
I think it's unique based off of the person and the why, and truly understanding that situation. When you get into note investing, the first thing people typically tell you is, and again, we're talking about first position notes, which is what we primarily invest in. We do invest, you know, some seconds, but I mean, our main bread and butter is that first position. And when in first position, you're taught to really focus on the property and what is the value of the property, the condition of the property, does it have clean title, are the taxes paid? And a lot of times they'll say, you don't need to worry about the borrower, because your recourse is that property on default. So us adding that the person or the why, I think adds tremendous value. And how we first evaluate that why is we will, during the due diligence before we buy a loan, request from the seller the comments, the servicing comments, which are all the comments or conversations that have gone back and forth throughout the years, to go through those and read them. And some of them could be 100 pages to really understand the whole process of what happened. The borrower may have been paying for 7 years, and then there was a life event. What was that life event? And is that life event something that has been remediated, or has it caused a change in lifestyle or financial situation, which is the position, to understand how we can, if we do acquire that note, first we will look at whether or not we will still acquire it, but what is the best solution to try and work something out with that borrower?
And so I guess kind of let's start back at the beginning, and we'll kind of go through these as we would if we were actually looking to acquire. If we received a tape of 10 notes, what's the first thing you look at? Like when you're like, just when you first glance at it, what are you looking at?
Yeah. So when we do first glance at it, we look at the amount they owe, how far are they behind, and the property, you know, and we'll take the information, and a tape is just a list of assets for sale. And we do have a calculator that we have created to analyze the financials on the loan in regards to if the borrower, we try and modify the loan, how do the financials look? If we did unfortunately have to foreclose, what do the financials look like? If the borrower is in or decides to file bankruptcy, what do the financials look like? We evaluate pretty much every situation possible to make sure that the exit strategies that we want to implement still make it viable for us and our investors, but also a potential viable solution for the borrower.
So that kind of covers like, well, when we break it down, you know, you have mentioned earlier property, person, position. So can we talk about the different, or can you talk about the different parts of the property and what we look at specifically?
Yeah. So one thing I just want to remind everybody is we don't get to look at the insides of these properties. If you own a house and your lender goes by, they knock at your door, you're not letting your lender in your house to inspect your house. The only time you do is if you're getting it reappraised. So you have to evaluate the house based on a visual inspection. And we will send somebody by the property to take a look at the property to, again, provide a report that's a visual inspection. And typically, I'd say, or the majority of the time, if the house isn't very cared for on the outside, chances are it's not very cared for on the inside. Now, if it's cared for on the outside, there's a higher chance that it's cared for on the inside, but that doesn't actually mean anything because I've had houses that look great on the outside and had scrape an inch of mold off the walls and 4 feet of water in the basement. So you can't always judge the property by just the outside. But looking at the property, again, just that one aspect, and the other part of the property that we look at is the title. On the property? Is the title clean? How many liens are on the property? Are the taxes paid on the property? So that is the property P, or the many different aspects that we try and roll up and to determine what is the value of the property when we're evaluating a note.
So is there a specific like loan to value that you look for when you're evaluating a note?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Like I speak with people all day who are interested in that question.
Yes. Well, first, for people who are listening or ask that question, I will first say we discount our price based off of the lower of the amount owed or the property value. So back during the downturn, almost 15 years ago now, you heard the term underwater, where people may owe $300,000 on their house and it's only worth $200,000. That means they're underwater, their loan to value is 150%. In that situation, we'd be bidding off of the $200,000 value of the property. So I would say we look to bid off of a acquisition price to value, which is the lower of those two. But in the same token, properties that do have equity are less risky.
Well, just kind of backing up for a second, because I realize maybe not everyone knows how to calculate loan to value. So how do you calculate loan to value? And I know we're kind of like going down a little bit of a rabbit hole, so I'll keep us back on track. But
okay. So loan to value is just the ratio of the amount of the loan versus the asset value. So let's say you owe $100,000 on your house and it's worth $200,000. Your loan to value is 50%. That's a good loan to value. The lower the better. And lenders like to see it at 80% or less, which is why if you have it greater when you're buying a house, you might be involved in mortgage insurance, which protects the lender in those situations. So the lower the better, and the lower the better at note investing, the reason why is if in this situation you owe 100 and it's worth 200, if that property drops by 25%, now the property is worth 150, well, you still owe 100 on it. So you still have a positive, you know, less than one loan to value. When it's greater than one, that goes back to that comment I made earlier about being underwater.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I guess to circle back, I'm like, wait, did he answer my original question?
We don't. And here's the reason why is one of the aspects I think that make us different when we bid on assets is we look at the type of return we're looking for and we look at the risk. So if there's a higher or closer to one loan to value, will we still acquire that asset? We will, but we're going to reduce our price because of the risk involved. That's why I mentioned previously, it's more of an acquisition price to value, because the higher the risk, to reduce that risk, we're going to lower our number. And if we don't get it, we don't get it. Many instances today, people are very aggressive. And in my mind, I think they're taking either, I would call it overbidding, which we don't do. they are taking on significant risk compared to the potential return they may obtain.
So you're basically not afraid to walk away from a deal, is what you're saying?
Correct. We walk away from many deals. On average, it fluctuates. Earlier on, there was probably a higher percentage because we were seeing a lot of assets that either the property or the information we got was not very accurate. As information's gotten more accurate, I'd say our rate of loans that we do not buy after we have them under agreement right now is probably somewhere around 25%.
And to clarify again, for those who might not be as familiar with the process, once you give your bids, your indicative bids, you have a 2 to 4 week period where you're able to do further due diligence, do that property condition report, look at the borrower notes, look at the borrower's financial position, and that, do you then adjust your bids based off what you find, or how does that work?
Correct. The best way I explain it, it's very similar like buying a house in a sense of you have it under agreement, then you got several weeks to do all your inspections and so forth. That's the same with a note because we're given very little information early on when you're bidding on those assets. So if we find out, for example, the borrower has delinquent taxes, we'll reduce the bid by the amount of taxes. The lender says the house is worth $250,000. We do an inspection and say it's worth $220,000. Then, of course, we would discount our bid in that situation. A lender says the loan has been performing. The borrower pays, we find out the borrower pays 3 times a year and paying 4 months at a time. That's not considered really a performing loan. They're bringing a loan current, but performing to me is consistent monthly payments. So all of those issues, and there's many others as well, just rattled off a few, would cause us to change our bid. And like I said, I'll go back to most people who are involved know how buying a home. You do a home inspection and realize, oh, it's going to need a new roof or need a new HVAC system. You reduce your number as part of your due diligence. You find something that devalued the property from your initial bid. It's no different than note investing, where we find things that are potential errors that could cost additional money. So we would then discount our final number based off of that.
Okay. So that kind of covers, well, more than just the property. Obviously, again, we went a little off track there, but I think it's important to kind of talk through our whole evaluation and acquisition process. So when, say, we have these notes, we purchased a bunch of notes, then we're looking at like the person and the position. Can you talk about a little bit about both, I guess? Let's start with the person.
Yeah, I'll start with the person. And like I mentioned, we will do research on that individual where we will called skip trace, which is something that you can look people up. That's all public record. So you can look people up where it gets their age, their address, criminal history, bankruptcy history, if they own any companies. Essentially, people are websites like White Pages. It's similar to like that on steroids, where we'll look up information on the borrowers to get kind of start painting that picture of their why. And then we'll get, like I said, those servicing notes and we'll go through them and we'll read them. And sometimes I'll search keywords as well. And we want to understand what was the cause. It could have been a divorce. It could have been a death in the family. It could have been a temporary loss of job. You know, those are typically the most common ones. But also, we evaluate the why to see if it's a loan that we want to continue to move forward on. And I say that because here's an example. We're looking at a loan where the borrower previously had filed bankruptcy like 3 times. It was a single mother who had gotten divorced and had 4 kids, all under the age of 12. And the borrower could not afford the property. And this was a situation where, looking at it, there was really no way we could help this borrower. And I wasn't going to be the one to buy this loan to then turn around and foreclose on somebody in that situation. So it was one where we decided to pass. Because it was not, to us, it didn't fit that criteria for a lot of the things we look for. So that's just one example. Also, some of the areas, the why, like I said, it's many different things. And the other one is health issues, and people may not have insurance and they racked up health bills. So that's a very common one we see as well.
So I guess my question would be, because I speak with a lot of people on my end who just think that you acquire the note straight to foreclosure. There's no other option. You just like full steam ahead foreclosure, even if the borrower is willing to work with you. And that's not, we do at 70, correct?
No.
I mean, I know. It's
So one of the other things with the why is there might be instances where there hasn't been a lot of borrower communication. Now, in those instances, we're not afraid where we still may proceed with acquiring that loan, but that is a loan where we will have an attorney and legal get involved sooner to bring them to the table or to try and bring that individual to the table to start having the discussions. Now, you know, when people typically get behind on the debt, their initial reaction is embarrassment. Or if they don't have an answer, they're not going to take the phone call. And a lot of times those debt collectors will be calling you like three times a day, just nonstop. And it's like, leave me alone is probably the initial reaction. So you want to make sure that they are A, aware that there's a new lender, but they're probably still going to ignore you because they think you're the same as every other lender. So we do sometimes have to get that attorney involved much sooner to get them to the table. Now, once we get an attorney involved and send what's called that demand letter, which is kind of the first stage, we're still absolutely willing to work with that borrower. The cost to send that information is not extraordinary. That is like the key time when the borrower has the best chance of, you know, really working out a deal that is, any deal typically is beneficial both sides. But once a lender starts having to really start spending attorney fees, it makes it a lot harder to work out certain deals because you're going to require them to bring more money to the table. Because if you do take a little bit of money and start over, let's say I spent $5,000 on legal and then we accept $1,000 for them. If we accept that money and they fail, then we start over. So we're going to have to go spend that $5,000 again. So it's kind of the communication and making sure you don't, neither side gets caught in the hamster wheel in that situation. So we do try and work with them early on. If they are in communication, then the servicer is very key as a member of the team, who's the person who collects the payments and keeps, you know, us compliant with all the state laws and federal laws. They will work something out and really kind of get an understanding of what happened so they can explain it to us, the next steps or the next phase of the process, so we can, again, go through that evaluation process.
Yeah, I think the key kind of thing that you touched upon there is communication. You know, I've had a handful of notes before, and just to give some examples where the borrower was so old, they didn't know how many times their loan had been transferred. And so once I sent the demand letter, they immediately brought their loan current. It's like they didn't know where to send their payment, which happens, I feel like, more often than I would have realized.
And here's, I think, one of the reasons why is most people like, okay, they mail their check or whatever. And it's your mortgage payment typically doesn't change. So sometimes they may get a letter from their lender and they just throw it away. They don't even open it or recycle it to see that the loan has been sold. And then all of a sudden that kind of
creates a snowball effect.
The other is when loans do get transferred, letters get mailed. But to me, I would think that is something that should be sent certified. It's not. And because it's not, like I said, it probably gets lost in a shuffle. I had one instance where a borrower filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, we're not going to go deep dive, but wipes you of all your debt. So you're not responsible for any of your debt. There is a little asterisk there that you don't get the free house, meaning you still have to pay what's owed, and that's, or the lender can still foreclose, but they can't go after you for any money. They just take the property. That's your only remedy. So this woman didn't know this, and this woman was elderly, and we basically couldn't get in contact with her. So we sent a demand letter. An attorney called who actually handled the bankruptcy and said, oh my God, she hasn't paid in 7 years. And between the accrued interest, late charges and everything, it was like a huge number. And he basically said, hey, she didn't realize that Chapter 7, can you do something with this borrower? And we said, yes, absolutely. And we did what's called a forbearance plan or trial payment plan, which is we don't modify the incomplete terms of the loan. We're like, hey, let's kind of put them on a training wheels plan and see if they can make the payments. And then if they make the payments, then we'll restructure the entire loan. And we did that. And the woman paid like clockwork. And then we ended up remodifying and structuring the loan that fit her criteria. For us, they absolutely fit within our parameters or what we're looking for returns. So again, that's just another example of you know, when we were getting that why, we also were seeing that in the servicing notes, nobody was ever reaching out to this person. And that's actually pretty common. And when that happens, you may not know the story, but the person probably does want to still pay, especially if they're living there, but nobody's ever reached out to them. So it's kind of out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. Again, it goes back to that communication, not only from the borrower to the servicer and the new lender, but also from the new lender to the borrower, like actually making that effort to figure out what the why is. And I think that's the biggest like difference in how we kind of approach notes, is that it's trying to figure out like what that why is. Again, it could be that they didn't know their loan was sold. And then you have this like increased awareness of everything being a scam. Then I receive a letter that says my note's been sold. I don't know. I'd probably, before being in this industry, be like, ah, is it really? Would have called my bank or my previous lender, whoever that was. But I think people have just like a heightened awareness of something being a scam. So I've definitely heard that before from borrowers. Trying to think if there's anything else that I'm like, you wouldn't think of.
Yeah, I just want to kind of jump in a little bit on that, because you're right about the scam, because this isn't going from, and I'm just going to use banks that everybody knows, it's not going from PNC to Wells or to Chase. It's going to a company that's like Johnny's Note Buying LLC might be buying this. And if I saw that, I'd be like, what is this? Like, it just sometimes reeks of like scam, because there's so many scams nowadays. So that's the other thing to look at, is if it was you, you read this letter, of course, I would call the person who I was sending payments to verify it, and then they would confirm it. But initial blush would be like, take this with a grain of salt.
Well, and that's where the demand letter comes in. So when we say we send a demand letter, it's kind of to show like, hey, we actually have like valid claim to this specific note, and show that it isn't a scam. So I kind of feel like even if you send the welcome packet and they don't say, they don't respond, you've tried calling, you've tried reaching out, that's where the demand letter comes in, as kind of like a, okay, like this is for real. And I think that's why a lot more people come to the table after the demand letter is sent, in my opinion. People might have differing opinions on that. You've been in the industry longer.
I also think it's from an attorney. So anytime you see something from an attorney, it's an initial like, uh-oh, I better open this.
Yeah. Okay. So talked about the property, the person, really how if the communication is key to get to know what the why is and see like the whole story. And then you have, okay, this person's come to the table and they're like wanting to get back on track. What we talk about the position of the borrower. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. And this is the financial position of the borrower. And
oh yeah, I guess you could think the position of the note, but no, the borrower.
Yes. So this is where, similar to if somebody was applying for a loan, the servicer requests, can you provide us your tax returns? Can you provide us your bank statements? Can you provide us your W-2? Provide us the information so we can evaluate what you can afford, if you can afford it. And unfortunately, a lot of times I'll go back to like my 27-year-old self, where I had two expensive cars, high credit card debt, a lot of those things. That is what you see a lot. And one of the things that I'll mention is, for us, which I'll call it an ethical situation, is someone will say, okay, I'm borrowing $2,500 to put this down, and then I'll afford $1,000 a month. And they haven't paid in 4 years. Well, if you haven't paid your mortgage in 4 years and you don't have $1,000 to your name and your situation hasn't changed, chances are you can't afford the thousand. And I would rather not take that person's money only to then turn around and foreclose on them. So that's one thing to evaluate, but it's really a process of confirming. And this is what Dodd-Frank would say, is, which is, were passed about 10 years ago. Now, the borrower's ability to repay. What is the likelihood that they do have that ability to repay? And I've seen borrowers who order out all day long, Amazon, and they have like four cars, and or four car loans, I should say, and the high cable bill, the high cell phone bill. And you'd like to get them help or some type of specialist to work with them to try and reduce and minimize and modify that debt. And in some instances, there's potential for success. Unfortunately, in most instances, it's not very successful. And that's where, you know, you go back to that why sometimes to see what that why is. Because if it's somebody's lifestyle, the lifestyle change is very challenging to get somebody to change their financial position. But again, if you're looking at the why and the financial position are tied, because if it was a one-off instance or a change from, again, a divorce or health in this, where they're back working and making that money again, and they just can't make that big lump sum payment, because what happens, I just want to remind people, is it's the snowball effect. If you miss one payment, now the bank's saying, hey, you got to give me both, the one you missed and a new one. Then you're like, I don't. Then it goes the next month. Well, now you got to make the previous two plus the one. So it's three. So it's like a snowball effect of, I could pay you one, or I could pay you one and a half. And some lender's like, nope, I need all three. And then it just keeps accumulating the late fees, the interest, the charges. So that's an area where you need to evaluate that financial situation. Say, okay, yes, we can take the $2,500 down. And it does look like you can afford $700 or $1,000 per month, whatever that payment is going to be. And we will put you again on a trial plan to make sure you get adjusted to making those payments and can live within your means during that time.
So you're basically, what you just said, just to make sure I understand it correctly,
you're taking everything I said in 5 minutes and saying in 10 seconds.
So instead of, you know, like you said, there's that snowball effect. So I might owe, like, let's say $50,000, but I had something happen, which was my why. And it's not my lifestyle. I do have the money to pay, like, get back on track. From our perspective, we can work with them to get them back on track without requiring that $50,000 up front.
In most instances, yes. Yeah. Again, I have to put a stipulation.
I know, disclaimer. No.
Because we've got a loan right now that has like a $400,000 reinstatement on it. And in that instance, you know, it's got a very high mortgage payment. Fortunately, in that instance, like $50,000 is not a lot compared to, you know, where the loan is. But yeah, typically we're talking usually like $250,000 homes with like $150,000 balance, and they might be like $10,000 or $15,000 behind. We try and work with them to try and get like 5-6 payments from them. But again, we evaluate the situation. We don't have a hard, fast rule. And as you know, we work with somebody who likes to have everything black and white sometimes. So if she's listening, she'll enjoy this. But it's somewhat a gray area of, okay, you know, there's no set rules. We can kind of that gray area of bending to see what fits what situation. That still could be a win-win for both sides. That makes sense?
That makes sense. And I guess kind of, can you name some of the different, obviously there's, you've mentioned trial payment plan, forbearance, loan modification. What are some other options like available to borrowers as they come to the table to like work something out?
Those payment plans that we try, if the borrower either doesn't want the house or can't afford the property and recognizes that, then there's what's called a deed in lieu of foreclosure, where instead of having us go through the foreclosure process, and we will basically have them just reissue us the deed as long as, again, it's clean title and there's no other issues on the property. Many instances, we would do what's called cash for keys, which is when they go to move out, give them a cash stipend to pay for their moving expenses, because we didn't have to absorb those legal fees or give that money to an attorney, are not opposed to working with them to give them those funds to A, maybe put as a deposit on a rental property, pay for moving, whatever that case may be. So that is another option. If it's underwater, meaning they owe more than what the property's worth, we potentially would allow them to do what's called a short sale. And with a short sale, unlike what people probably have in the back of the head is, oh my God, a short sale, lenders take forever. There's so much red tape and they never get put through. We're an investment company. We can approve a short sale in 5 minutes. We have number already in mind what we would approve. If it kind of hits that number, we'll make a decision instantaneously or within 24 hours and work that process. We don't have 7 levels or layers to go through different departments to get that approval, which could take months if you are a nationwide lender.
And I will note that with all of these, I think the thing that people like need to remember is that we are buying these at a discount. So we do have the ability to negotiate a little more freely. We have more wiggle room on all of these options. So I think that's something that people always might forget is like, wait, well, why can't a bank do this? Well, why can't whoever the original note holder do this? And then in today's market with home prices, what they are, another option would just be to sell the home.
Sell the home. What we see a lot now is because people, A, don't want to sell because their credit might be hit and interest rates are very high and rents are very high. So they kind of don't have a place to go and their rent might be more than a mortgage payment. Then they'll file bankruptcy. And bankruptcy isn't a bad thing. a lot of no investors like, oh man, bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is the ability.
I think a lot of people think, oh man, bankruptcy. Like, but it's kind of like, maybe I won't go this far, but it's kind of like when we had that episode on debt, like when used correctly.
Yeah. I mean, and bankruptcy is, if it's a chapter 13, which is, it's a restructuring of your debt. It's taking all your debt, taking what's secured, what's unsecured, figure out how much you can afford and putting you on a plan for typically 5 years to get yourself back on track. Now, unfortunately, in today's world of everybody wants everything instantaneously, real estate investors want to make $1 million and buy 10 properties in their first month. People want cryptocurrency to triple their money, whatever it is. Everyone wants everything like instantaneously in today's world. Unfortunately, that's not reality. And 5 years is a lot of time. But in bankruptcy, you know, you have 5 years to, again, restructure that debt. And how it works typically on the notes that we buy is the borrower still makes that monthly payment that they owe. And then whatever was past due, basically it's kind of rolled up in a ball, divided by 60, essentially 60 months or 60 payments. And, you know, you're paid chunks of that on a monthly basis as well. What's nice about bankruptcy is if the borrower hasn't been communicating with you, now they're not going to communicate with you because they can't in bankruptcy, but they have to fill out a lot of financial information to provide to the courts. So it's almost as if they're communicating to you because all of that information becomes available for you to see.
Yeah, I think as investors, obviously you want someone who's what you call like a serial filer.
Yeah,
that's a very different story. Yes. But again, it can be used for borrowers as a tool to help them get back on track. So I think it has a really negative connotation because of serial filers. But again, I mean, I've had a borrower who filed for bankruptcy, and I was getting those consistent payments and everything got back on track. So not necessarily always a bad thing.
Yeah. And if I had to guess, and again, I have not analyzed this data like as of today, so mm-hmm. I'm kind of spitballing it. But if we had 100 loans that are delinquent and which bucket they fell into regarding how many do we like try and modify to work out how many go to bankruptcy versus how many go to foreclosure, I would say, actually, I'll ask you, what do you think the foreclosure would be out of 100?
Oh man, I actually gone through this with specifically 100 notes. So this is really funny. I'd say like 30 of them are like in our portfolio. Again, I haven't like analyzed it as of today, but I would say like in a fund specifically, maybe 30 of them are performing. I would say, so the rest other 70 are non-performing. And then I'd say maybe like 10 to 15 of those are actually like go to foreclosure, maybe even less, all the way through. Is that what you were going
to
say?
I was going to say 10 to 15. Yes.
Yeah. Like people think, and that's the thing when I'm kind of, I go through this whole analogy with people who are really interested in our workout process. I'm like 30 of them are performing. That leaves 70. Of those 70, we would say, try to get in contact with the borrower, probably send a demand letter. Of those 70, let's say like half those come to the table and are like ready and willing. You're like laughing because you agree. We haven't discussed this, but this is kind of having worked with you and having done my own, I'd say, so of 70, 35 come to the table and are like, okay, like let's do something. And it's maybe again, because they thought it was a scam or they're, you know, an older borrower who didn't know how many times, couldn't follow how many times their loan was being sold. Then you have 35 more that might take a little bit more to come to the table, whether that's you need to go another step in the foreclosure process, then they realize you're serious, then they'll come to the table. And then you have like 10 to 15. And even of those 10 to 15, like I'd say five are just totally either vacant or borrower's deceased or something super crazy. So maybe leaving 10 of those that are actual all the way through. When you get to that point as a lender, or at least we at 7E, we've made every effort to reach out to the borrower to try to get them to come to the table to evaluate their why, what their financial position is. And they're basically have been like, I haven't paid in 10 years. I'm not paying you a dime. And that is like a very different stance from someone who's like, look, like I had a major health scare and I couldn't afford my mortgage. Like help me, versus someone who literally will say to your face, like, I'm not going to give you a thing. I haven't paid. Why would I start paying now?
No, those numbers are kind of like spot on. And like I said, and again, the balance, like I said, bankruptcy as well. And of some of those foreclosures, you hit the nail on the head. It's most of them don't want the property. So that's where we end up taking them back. Whether, again, it's family member passed away, divorce, relocation, property, they didn't feel like listing it or selling it, or they just had to move quickly, whatever the case may be. There's a million different reasons of why people need to move or no longer are interested in that property. And that's part, again, goes back to that why. The person in the why is, what is that story that we try and analyze? And when we're analyzing that, we make sure the numbers, of course, still work, which is that aspect that I think a lot of people do not take into account. And by analyzing it, again, it also gives us a better picture for the risk that we're getting into.
Yeah, I've worked with a few different investors, you and prior to you, that did things very differently. Like, I know someone who I worked with that would go straight to foreclosure, like didn't matter what the why was, the financial position. It was like, we are going, moving forward full steam ahead. And then I've worked with people who literally just try to, no matter what, like don't go to foreclosure at all. They've only tried to work something out with the borrower, and they've actually had really good success, which is not what you would think when you're getting into this business, because that's not kind of how it's, I guess, described, but yeah.
Well, another interesting point is, like, I know another investor, they will foreclose and they just basically buy loans to foreclose on them. And the way the economy and housing has been the last 3 years, very profitable for that individual, because, I mean, they get it, they'd foreclose, they get the property, and that property just keeps appreciating, you know, month over month that we've had the last year. Now, will that continue in the next few years? That's another time, another debate. And, you know, someone made the comment, like, why didn't you change your philosophy to that? And I'm like, because that's just not my philosophy. That's not our business plan. That's not the way we operate. Is there ways that people could, it's like any business, there's other ways people can make money or do better in one area versus the other. But for us, the way we analyze things, by getting them to work out, we can do very well. And if we take it back, we still do very well. A lot of times they like to do what we'll call is the home run hitters. They either want to hit a home run every time, or they also strike out as well. For us, we're much happier getting our singles, doubles, triples. And, you know, as part of that, we'll get a hanging curveball down the middle that we can also hit for a home run. And we have a lot more doubles, triples, and home runs than we do strikeouts. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's like that consistency. And we're still able to meet our investors, meet what we promise to investors, and do well.
I just want to make that past performance is not an indicator of future success, because I was just talking about things. So just want to make that stipulation again.
I also believe in karma. And I think that, I don't know, I took that from someone who would only do workouts for that reason. And I do, I think there's like a level of just like karma that goes into it.
Oh yeah. I believe absolutely. And we're not going to argue whether karma is real, but it's kind of one of the things where you believe in it, then yeah. So I got a question for you.
Okay.
Put you on the spot. Of the three, person, position, or property, which one is the most important?
Oh, well, the property.
Yeah, it still is. I mean, it still comes down to the property is the most important.
You're making your evaluating whether you're going to hit a single, double, triple, whatever. Baseball's like not my favorite sport on the buy. Like what you bid on the property. It's, I guess, the property is the most important because it helps you dictate what you're going to purchase that property at, or that note at. And the rest kind of flows from there, like being able to work with the borrower because of their position and their why all stems from what you purchased the property at and doing a good job on the purchase, or not, and the property, the note.
And most people, because it's most important, they just do a one-dimensional. They'll just look at the property itself, and going back to that three-dimensional picture of property, person, position, I think it does give us a competitive advantage.
I agree. Any final thoughts?
That was my final thought.
So no more.
I'm gonna end. I'm like, that's a strong finish.
That was good. That was good. Just in case. I didn't know if you had like more. So with that, I will wrap it up. Thank you guys so much for joining us today on this episode of the CWS podcast. If you enjoyed the show, share it with a friend or subscribe and leave us a review. Thanks, guys. Thank you all. Until next time.
Take care.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.